We are in our final final discussions about the tests of Abraham, the life and times of Abraham, the tribulations of his life. And chapter 21, I know it says chapter 14 in source number 1, it's a mistake. It should say chapter 21. It contains three tests, essentially. We'll see how these are counted at the end. And this chapter is actually comes in combination with the previous chapter. The previous chapter is the story of Avimelech and Avimelech's the incident with Avimelech and Sarah. So this story comes on the heels of that story, where Avimelech's house is plagued, and they eventually are healed from this, and they make a sort of peace at the end. It's not the end of the Avimelech story. We'll see that it comes back in this chapter, and it serves somewhat as a bookend between that story and the story of the birth of Yitzchak, and the banishment of Hagar and Ishmael. This passage, this text that we're going to look at, is the Torah reading that we read on Rosh Hashanah. It's one of the Torah reading, the two Torah readings that we read on Rosh Hashanah. It's the story of Sarah giving birth to Yitzchak after all of the anticipation, the prayer, the frustration, finally arrived at this moment. And we read the story, and one of the explicit connections is the opening pasuk. So let's read the opening pasuk. Vahashem pakad et Sarah kasher amar, vayas Hashem l'Sarah kasher diber. The Lord remembered Sarah as he had said, and Hashem, the Lord, did to Sarah as he had spoken. And this phrase, Hashem pakad et Sarah, he remembered Sarah, the key term here, the key idea, key concept here, is the term pakad, which means to remember. Or, as I put here in source number 2, the Gemara in Masechet Rosh Hashanah, Tractate Rosh Hashanah, says pikdonot harein kezichono, which means that the idea of pakad is related to the idea of memory. And what's going on here is God, Hashem, kivyachol, on a certain level is actually having a remembrance of Sarah and a remembrance of the fact that he had made a promise that he would give her a child, he would grant her a child. And this language of memory is something that bears a very strong foundation to the day of Rosh Hashanah itself. On Rosh Hashanah, we ask Hashem to remember us, to remember our good deeds, to remember our ancestors' good deeds. And many of the passages, one of the sections of the Musaf prayer on Rosh Hashanah is called Zichronot. Zichronot is the section of the Musaf prayer on Rosh Hashanah which causes Hashem through our prayer to bring up the Maaseh Avot, the great moments of our history, that Hashem should remember us for the good. And that is one of the main ideas of why we mention this idea on Rosh Hashanah, this passage on Rosh Hashanah. Also the story of Chana. The story of Chana also speaks about the woman who also could not have children. She was barren in the beginning of the book of Samuel, of Shmuel, Shmuel Aleph. And it uses language of Hashem remembered her, and Hashem granted her, Pakad and Zachar, also by Rachel, similar type of language is used, and in other places as well. And this word, and this phraseology is coming to highlight or emphasize, more than just to remember, it's also this idea of something that's a long-awaited destiny, something that's been brewing and building and getting to a certain point that we've been waiting for quite some time. And
there's no indication why Sarah could not conceive before
it. Well, we spoke about it.
She didn't do anything wrong, did she?
Right. We spoke about one possibility that she had some kind of health.
Health, but nothing. Like,
right. Other than what Rabbeinu Bachai is about to say in source number 3, which I think is ultimately the religious reason, how we understand these episodes, especially in the book of Bereishit, when we speak about the barrenness of the foremothers, of the imahot, of Sarah, Rebecca, and so on. And the Rabbeinu Bachai writes here in source number 3, when it says, Vaya Hashem Lasar Kasher Diber, as God had said, that's a reference to her giving birth. And this is why the Torah immediately follows by recording, she became pregnant and gave birth. The reason the Torah wrote this paragraph, and this often we've raised this question, why is one story placed next to the previous story, to the prior story? And this story comes immediately after having informed us of the closing of the birth canals in Avimelech's household. That was the plague that came on Avimelech's household, that they were unable to have children. That's there to remind us that both the so-called natural process of becoming pregnant, so quote-unquote natural process, we see it as just, of course, a woman's going to get pregnant and be able to have a child, and giving birth, and the inability to bear a child, to conceive a child, are both in God's hands. They're both bidei shamayim. God alone is in charge of who becomes pregnant and who does not. And again, ultimately, it's a religious reason. It's not a medical discussion like maybe we had in a different. But it is a reminder to us about this. Formulated in different words, I want to share with you the words of Rabbi Jonathan Sacks from his essays in this parsha. I believe they were in last year's edition on the parsha of Vayera, where this passage appears. And he's basically addressing the question, why was it such a drawn-out process? So he says, finally, the story, this is source number 4, the story seems to have a happy ending. After all the promises and prayers, Abram and Sarah at last have a child. Then come the words, which in all the intervening centuries, we're going to focus on this story next week in our last discussion, have not lost their power to shock. After these things, God tested Abraham, so on and so forth. Take your son, your only son. Abraham takes his son, travels for 3 days, climbs the mountain, prepares the wood, ties his son, takes the knife and raises his hand. Then a voice is heard from heaven. Do not lay a hand on the boy. The trial is over. Isaac lives. Why all the promises and disappointments, he asks? Why the hope so often raised, so often unfulfilled? Why delay? Why Ishmael? Why the binding? Why put Abraham and Sarah through the agony of thinking that the son for whom they have waited for so long is about to die? We cherish what we wait for and what we most risk losing. Life is full of wonders. The birth of a child is a miracle. Yet precisely because these things are natural, we take them for granted, forgetting, turn the page, that nature has an architect and history an author. Judaism is the sustained discipline in not taking life for granted. That is why, at the dawn of Jewish time, God put Abraham and Sarah through these trials. The long wait, the unmet hope, the binding itself, so that neither they nor their descendants would ever take children for granted. Every child is a miracle. Being a parent is the closest we get to God, bringing life into being through an act of love. So here we have a statement about appreciating the fact that, of course, it was a great miracle that Sarah could give birth at such an advanced age, and at the same time, trying to appreciate how there's a bigger story being told here about Jewish history, that the birth of Yitzchak and the waiting, and then being told that it's all going to come to an end in the binding of Isaac in the Akedah. It's all a reminder about appreciation and cherishing what we sometimes take for granted, often take for granted. I brought here the words of Rav Shlomo Karlbach in source number 5. If you ever heard him sing before or speak before, he would say these words with probably playing guitar in the background. And here's how he put it. He phrased it. You know, my beautiful friends, imagine if Avram and Sarah got married and had a son right away. What would it sound like to you? It might be beautiful, but something is missing, because Jewish children are not just born because man and woman get together and decide to have children. There are two levels of having children. There's a level of having children because this is the nature of the world. You get married, you have children, and the world has to continue. But then there's the higher level. We are longing for something that hasn't happened before, and I know and believe that my children will bring it. My grandchildren will bring that day. Therefore, Yitzhak was only born after Avram and Sarah reached that level of longing. So we savor and appreciate that which we wait for with much more enthusiasm and excitement. And part of the mitzvah of belief in Mashiach, for example, is about the anticipation that Tzipi Tal Yeshua, and this maybe explains how the custom that many have in the week before marriage, that the bride and the groom, the chatan and the kala, remain apart and don't see each other or speak to each other for an entire week before they have their wedding. And one of the ideas behind this custom is that there should be an excitement, an anticipation, a build-up toward an amazing moment in a person's life. And maybe that appreciation that needed to be built in very early in history was the challenge and the test that was being sent the way of Avram and Sarah. So let's go back to source number one and read about what happened in this birth.
Just before you go on.
Go ahead.
I mean, today we know that some couples, some women can have children much more easy than other women. Are you saying it's you know, someone's controlling this and someone's saying, you know, hey, you're going to have children, you know, the year after you get married, and you're never going to have children, or you're going to wait 10 years? I mean, it just sounds so unfair that it's not the individual that hasn't done anything to cause this.
Right. I think it's the question. I mean, part of the answer is, why does God give people tests? If we believe that God tests people, in other words, why that person?
Why that person and not that person? That couple, not that.
100%.
How do you counsel a woman who has been trying to have kids for 10 years and can't have kids? How do you counsel them?
It's
what kind of test is God putting that person to compared to the one who has?
So I'm hoping
they look at each other and they're pregnant.
I'm hoping that next week in our final discussion, we're going to look at this broader question about why Hashem tests people in general, why certain people maybe get different kinds of tests than others. We'll try to address that in our concluding thoughts next week. But it is a difficult question. It's a very tough call. It's a very difficult idea to swallow.
As a doctor will say.
Yeah,
we got in vitro.
Well, now we do, but they didn't do it in the days of Abraham.
Well, certainly not if you're a 98 or 90.
Right. So let's turn back and read some of the text of this story inside. We're in verse 2, Pasuk Bet, source number 1. Vatar vatelet Sarah l'Avraham bein l'skunav. Sarah has this child, and you'll notice just in the first three verses, the name of Sarah appears 4 times. So she clearly is becoming a very central figure in this story, particular in this story of the birth of Isaac, of Yitzchak. So she has the child, and exactly at the time that had been predicted by the angels or the visitors that had come to the tent that year before, that year prior. Verse 3, Vayikra Abraham et Shem Benoha No'olo Sheyaldolo Sarah. There again you see her name. The name of this son who had been born, Yitzchak. And his name is Yitzchak, Isaac. Vayamal Abraham et Yitzchak Beno, the first child in history to be given a circumcision at 8 days old, Ben Shmonat Yamim, Kasher Tziva Oto Elokim. Verse 5. The Avraham ben Me'at Shana. Very interesting. It lists Abraham's age, but it doesn't list Sarah's age. It says Abraham was 100 years old when he had Yitzchak, and it doesn't tell us about Sarah's age. And it's a curious omission, if you want to call it that. One commentary says that the reason here for emphasizing Avraham's age is or de-emphasizing Sarah's age is to show that she was 90 years old. We know that, but she was not physically 90 years old. So for to list her age as 90 years old would be kind of strange, considering the fact that she's having a child at that age. So leaving out her age gives us the sense that she had become youthful. She had somehow, some way, through some miraculous event, become more youthful and being given the ability to have a child at that advanced age. And the alternative idea or additional idea is that exactly as Abraham had been promised, right? And Abraham said, am I going to have a child at 100 years old at such an advanced age? Right? Halven me'asha na'yivaleid. And that's exactly what happened. He did have a child. So it's emphasizing Abraham's age because it's almost a fulfillment of what he had kind of been shocked about when he had been told that this was to come. But Tomer Sarah, verse 6, Tzachok asali Elokim kol shamei yitzachak li, and here it's being expressed the joy, not necessarily in a You know, that the time before when Sarah laughed, it was more of a, you could call it a laugh of disbelief, or a laugh of how could it really be, you know, that this is going to happen to me. Here it was turned into a laughter of joy, a laughter of wow, this, it's so amazing that this was able to I was able to experience this. Vatomer mimi lel Avraham, verse 7, heinika vanim Sarah ki yeladti bein liskunav. She says, right, who would have said, to Avram and Sarah would nurse children, right? I have borne a son to his old age. Almost like, who would have ever thought that this could have ever happened? Vayigdal hayeled, the child grows up. Vayigamal, he's weaned at the end of a nursing period. Vayas Avraham yishteh gadol. And by the way, that's mentioned here, and some of the commentaries point this out as well. Not just that Sarah was able to give birth, she was able to nurse the child. She was able to go through with the period of nursing the child. Probably biologically, it would make sense. I was talking to my wife about this. It makes sense that if a person was able to give birth, then that process brings on the ability to nurse. At the advanced age, it's being highlighted, you know, the level of the miracle. Vayas Avraham yishteh gadol, b'yom higamel Yitzhak. And Avraham makes this great party. This incredible party. The other woman in history who had a similar type of reaction to a birth was Chana, who we mentioned before. Hannah, who was also barren and then had the child Shmuel. We're going to turn now to source number 6. She also celebrated by bringing her child up to Shiloh, which was at the time the location of the Mishkan. And there too she celebrated together with her family. And the story continues. And the story takes a turn, and it takes a turn for a very difficult time in Jewish history, a very difficult, challenging test, according to some, one of the most difficult tests that Abraham was faced with in his life. And here it is in verse 9, source number 6. Vatera Sarah, on the second page, Ed Ben Hagar Hamitzrit. Sarah sees the son of Hagar the Egyptian, Asher Yalda LaAbraham Mitzachek. And what is this boy doing? What is the son doing? And again, you'll notice there's no name. We know his name. His name is Ishmael, but Sarah never refers to these people by name. She's very off-putting in terms of the relationship piece. She doesn't want to even relate to the child as having an identity.
But didn't she bring Hagar to him?
She wasn't too happy about it after the fact, as we know. We studied that story. Yeah. So what does the word mitzachek mean? What does it mean that Ishmael was
having a party.
Making merry? So if you look in Rashi, in source number 7, at the bottom of that page, Rashi refers the word mitzachek to the three capital crimes of Judaism. There's worshipping idols, which is the first one, and in each instance, he brings a verse that uses the word tzachak, right? To laugh or to have joy, to be merry, and he references a place in the Torah where this word is used in reference to some kind of illicit behavior. So here the first one is avodah zarah, idolatry, murder. Murder is also mentioned with the word vayisachaku, to make sport, and then the last one, of course, is avodah zarah, giloy arayot, immoral sexual immorality. By the story of Joseph and Potiphar, you have the word letzachek. So in each instance, you find the word tzachak, to make merry, to make a mockery of something. So Yishmael is being portrayed by the text, the way Rashi understands it, as not being very well behaved. In fact, being very poorly behaved, and the type of behavior that he was displaying was very troubling in the eyes of Sarah.
So how old would he be now?
Very good question. We're going to see that the calculation seems to put him around the age of 17. 16 or 17. which makes this story
post bar mitzvah.
Remember, he had his bris milah in the previous story, and there's some time that elapses between then and Isaac being born, and then you have to calculate in the nursing period as well. So all this is taking place post that time. And the Talmud talks about women would nurse I'm sure still today, but maybe not as common in North America, for up to 2 years sometimes. And sometimes maybe even longer than that. But if you do the calculation, we're talking probably 3 or 4 years after the bar mitzvah age of Yishmael, which makes the story very interesting, because he's not a little kid
right. In
the story. He's not a little boy. He's grown. If you look at the end of Rashi in source 7, one of the things that Sarah was concerned about was the issue of the inheritance. This was a big growing concern. Sarah's reply, "The son of this bondsman shall not be heir with my son." You may infer that he was quarreling with Isaac about the inheritance. So some see people, mitzachek, saying, "I am the firstborn and I will therefore take a double portion." They went into the field, and Yishmael took his bow, shot arrows at Isaac, and this is, you know, like a madman who casts firebrands, arrows, and death, and says, "I'm only mocking, I'm only playing, right? I'm not actually trying to kill him, I'm just playing a game." Sarah didn't like any of this behavior, she didn't like where it was going, and in a way, it was kind of looking into the future and saying, this is the kid who's going to take on the legacy of Abraham, of Avraham. This is not something that I want to be supportive of. So she's getting very nervous. But Tomer la Avraham, she says to Avraham, I'll just read one more commentary here at the top of source 8 on the third page. We don't know exactly what Yishmael is doing or which interpretation of Tzachak he's acting upon. In fact, it might be relevant, it might not be relevant at all, for what Yishmael is doing could be literally translated as he was Isaacing. Because the word Yitzchak and Mitzachek are from the same root, from the same root word. So what does it mean he was Isaacing? He says that Yishmael is seeking Isaac's place, right? This should come as no surprise. Yishmael, for 13 years, is the only son, understands that he is the son of the maidservant. Yishmael must realize that despite being the firstborn, the other child's lineage supersedes his. And Yishmael's response is to become Isaac. He wants to become Isaac, and Sarah catches him trying to take on this role. So let's look back in the story now and see how it plays out. Back on the second page in source number 6, verse 10, Pasuk Yud. Vatomer la Avraham. Sarah turns to her husband Avraham, and she says to him, Garesh ha'ama hazot. Garesh ha'ama hazot, drive out this, listen to the ordering here, drive out the handmaid, ve'et bina, and her son. Which means, you have to get rid of both of them, in that order. Hagar, and again, no mention of anyone's name. Notice that again. And the word garesh is a very strong word of rejection. Where else do we have this phrase, garesh? We have it in the banishment of Adam and Eve from the Garden of Eden. It's a very strong symbol of what it means to be rejected, to be sent away, to be pushed away. And that's what's going on here. Sarah is saying they have to be gone from this place. And again, the phrase maidservant comes up twice in verse 10 in Pasuk Yud, Ki lo yirash ben ha'ama hazot im b'ni im Yitzchak. This, right, the son of this bondwoman, this maidservant shall not be an heir with my son, right, with my son. And that's Sarah's very strong stance and statement here. And guess what Avram's reaction is? Avram's reaction, Vayera, verse 11, Vayera hadavar me'od b'nei Avraham aladot b'no. Avraham was very upset. He was upset. This is his child. And look at the wording here. It's not anymore ben Hagar hamitzrit. How is Yishmael referenced in verse 11? B'no, his son. Who else is called b'no? Yitzchak is called Beno. This is Abraham's child. And he is between, a rock and a hard place. Now if you look for a second, just turn to the next page for a second. We'll come back to the story in a moment. Just want to point out a few comments here. First of all, the Sforno in Source 9, he comments on the ordering. Why, when Sarah instructs her husband about this banishment, she first mentions banish Hagar and then mentions banishing the child, the son. So he writes, seeing that what the son did was at the instigation of his mother, she saw the mother as the main culprit, as the main influence on Yishmael's life. He spread lies about Yitzhak's legitimacy. This is a reference to the previous story of Avimelech, that people were claiming that Yitzhak was not born from Abraham and Sarah, but rather Avimelech and Sarah, because Avimelech had kidnapped Sarah, if you remember our reading of that story in the previous class. And in that incident, there was a suspicion that perhaps Avimelech had impregnated Sarah, because soon after that, she ends up actually being pregnant and having a child. So one of the solutions to that problem was, if you recall, Yitzchak had the likely features of his father in order to dispel those suspicions.
Why
did you take him DNA? Yeah, DNA. But Yishmael, right? Yishmael was someone who was maybe fanning the flames of this rumor of this, and Sarah saw this kind of behavior. Now, this to me is so emotional, this whole story. Imagine the father, Avram, has to go through with this, and he's basically commanded by God. In the next verse, listen to your wife. Whatever your wife tells you to do, listen to your wife. If you look in the commentary of Rabbi Rafal Shimshon Rafal Hirsch, here in source number 10, he says the following. He says, Kol hamase hazeh nireh b'ene Avram achzari b'yoter. Can you imagine? Who was the greatest symbol of righteousness and chesed at that time in history, and maybe in all of history, was Abraham. Always looking to help others, to invite people into his tent, to pray on behalf of the city of Sodom, to take care of his wife and his children and his house. This was Abraham. And here he's being asked to do something which is against every fiber of his being and what he stands for. And it's cruel. He writes, "It's achzari. It's a emotion of cruelty. Nitar er kol mashikibel b'libo laasot kol tziyrei nafsho legabei atido. Imagine v'zot lo rak b'yechas Yishmael gam b'yechas imo. There's a few things going on. It's not just Yishmael. There's a mother. There's two people involved in the story. Shnei advarim ayu ra'im be'inav. Rav Hirsch looks at this. He says both of them were difficult for Avram to swallow, that he would have to go through this. Ach lo mitoch netiya yishid al Hagar. It wasn't specifically because of Hagar. He cared less about Hagar. Ki maldot b'no. He cared much more about the son, about the child. Mitami makshirim b'no b'ovad. Bevadai lo ne'alam yinei Avraham. Third line, davar shivchina bosara. Ulam min astam chashav Avraham. Avram thought like this. Im kvar b'beito satay Yishmael mider shalkovik. Can you imagine, under Avraham's watch, Yishmael was already starting to leave the path. If that was what was happening in such a house, like Avraham's house, where he taught the values and the lessons that he did. Rosh v'haya l'mitzachek. You look at the influence of Hagar, the mother, on her son. Here Abraham was able to have a say. I don't know, you know, maybe what kinds of conversations he had together with Hagar. What school are we going to send him to? And, you know, which shul, which youth group are we going to send him to?
And the cost.
You know, and I don't know what extracurricular activities are we going to sign them up for. And these are the conversations that are going on between Avram and Hagar about their son Yishmael. And even then, even with Avram's ability to have influence, he saw that Hagar's influence was overpowering. That made him very nervous. So logically, we understand why the decision had to be made. Because the environment was toxic. The environment of Hagar, and the environment of Hagar and her influence on Yishmael, and then through being in that environment, Yitzchak, by osmosis and by being in the room, being in the same home, would end up.
What they expect? I mean, they brought the maiden in to give birth. That was the whole purpose of it. It was to produce progeny.
But could they tell the future? Could they tell the future? And this is something that that greatly troubled Avraham. And the text is so explicit about it. So let's read how the story unfolds. Go back to the previous page in source 6. Vayomer Elohim, verse 12, El Avraham, God says to Avraham, Al yirabei necha, he says, don't be displeased about this, al anar, v'al amatecha, notice he's called the nar here, and the maidservant, kol asher tamar elecha sarah, shema bikola, everything that Sarah tells you, listen to her voice. Ki biyitzchak yikarei lecha zara, because in Isaac is going to be your legacy and your seed. And then, v'gamet ben amal goya simenu ki zarachahu, but don't worry, Avraham, Yishmael will also become a great nation. God isn't forgetting about Yishmael. God isn't forgetting about the promise that he made to Avram that Yishmael was going to be great, which we spoke about it already at length, that Yishmael was going to have descendants, 12 princes were going to come from his family. And Avram was constantly concerned about what was to be. And after this event, there isn't that much more contact that takes place. But what we do know, and what we do have from Midrashim, is that Avram tried to keep contact. And he loved his son. And this was obviously a heart-wrenching decision for him. And we need to appreciate that in the way that God speaks to Avram and reassures him and says, yes, there is going to be a separation, a painful separation, but know that the promise that Yishmael is also going to be great. I haven't forgotten about that. And Avram has to accept it because God tells him you have to listen to your wife and your wife is making this decision and you have to hear it. Vayashkem Avraham baboker, Avram wakes up in the morning, and again, the language here of early rising, we've seen a number of times. Avram waking up, we're going to see it again next week with the story of the Akedat Yitzchak. Avram wakes up is a sense of urgency, a sense of zrizut, a sense of something important is happening here. Some people say Vayashkem means he couldn't sleep, right? He woke up because he couldn't sleep, either out of excitement or anticipation or fear. Perhaps this case, I would say, probably more on the fear end of the emotions. And he takes bread and chemat mayim, a flask of water. Vayiten al Hagar, samal shichma, and he gives it to Hagar, puts it on her shoulder. Probably not the child on her shoulder, as we said, Yishmael was a teenager. Vatayelad vayishocha, gives her the child vayishocha, and he sends them vatelach vateta bamibar. Be'er Shava. And I brought for you some art that has been, you might have seen these before. These are two different depictions of this scene of the sending off of Yishmael from the house and from different perspectives. And there's obviously a lot to consider when you look at them. Each one portrays it in different fashion. But in each, you get a sense of what this might have felt like or might have looked like, and that's what is trying to be portrayed. And Vayeshkem Avraham Baboker, if you look in source 11, turn to source 11. The commentary here says Afal Pisha Gufa Masa Yaram Meod Beinei Avraham. This was something that Avraham, as we said, he wasn't so happy about it. He wasn't so excited about it. Hare Mishapasa Kono. When his creator has told him, Kol asher tamar lecha sarah, if you're supposed to listen to your wife, batel da'ato, which means you have to put away your ego. If your wife is talking to you, she's giving you the instruction, that's the time to listen to her. And he did it with haste. Bezizut, b'chipazon, shalom bayit. That was what was crucial over here. Making sure that the relationship between Abraham and Sarah was maintained at a level of power, at a level of strength, even to the extent that Avram had to go through with such a painful decision. When Atol Shon Hayelad, he writes in the third line, V'ramazakatuv l'chibar Avram Elav, speaking about him as the Yeled, right? Again, that was in Pasuk, Basuk Yedalad, it speaks about the child as his ben, as his yelad. These are terms of endearment. Avram loved the child. He loved Ishmael.
Doesn't look 17 in those pictures.
Right, I know. This one's depicting him as a lot younger. It's true. And I think that one as well.
They're almost the same age.
Right. Right. It's interesting that they're portrayed in the same, kind of the same age. I'm good. I have more in here. Thank you.
You know, a couple of years ago, I saw an Israeli movie. It's really the story in modern times,
yeah.
Israel. I forget the name of it, but I see all the things happen, but with modern people,
right.
How it works.
Right.
I'm surprised every woman doesn't have that.
I know.
Listen to your wife.
That's right. And again, the Torah is very, very brief in this parting experience. There's no, there's no blessing. There's no, just some kind of word of exchange, you know, that takes place between them. Imagine how that parting moment. It's very difficult. Very difficult to kind of wrap your head around the whole story. He reads it as the silence of the text, that there wasn't really a description of any kind of interaction between the parties here, is a reflection on the pained emotion of the story. The inability, almost like the inability to find words at such a moment. And I would just mention that it is said that this was, according to many of the commentaries, the most difficult test that Abraham went through. Even more difficult than the Akedah. Which is something to kind of reflect on. It's a strong statement. To think about that as the hardest test that Avram had to endure. I mean, you could say he hasn't endured the Akedah yet. So up until this point, it was the most difficult test. But maybe even overall. And then he says, if you look in the end, it's interesting. Remember, Hagar, this is not the first time that Hagar is being pushed out of a house. First time around, Sarah, you know, basically got her to get out of the house because she was very upset. After Hagar had a child, and then Hagar was mocking her, and Sarah wouldn't have it, and Sarah gave Hagar a hard time, and Hagar ran away. And where did she run away to? Presumably back to Egypt. And here she wanders in the desert.
No mention of Sarah or Isaac in this. He just said, gave us a date.
Yeah, it's true. And what's interesting is, you know, if she was wandering, where were they? They were in the area around Avimelech, Gerar, which I think we mentioned in the past, is basically southeast, near Egypt, not too far away. She probably knew her way around, presumably.
Why'd she go back to Egypt?
That was where she was from.
Why'd she go back?
Why didn't she go back? She got lost.
Yeah.
She got lost. Meaning the question is, why did she get lost? Why couldn't she find her way? What happened over here? So he writes in the end of Source 11, Ki masa brichata yadagar b'diyuka derech halacha mitzrayma. Kanta, that here she was wandering, that the earlier time she knew exactly where to navigate. V'tiya zo romezet l'tzara shel Hagar. This wandering is a reflection of her pain, of the pain that she was enduring. L'ye'usha, she was giving up hope. A person who wanders is a person who doesn't have any purpose, who doesn't have any mission, who doesn't have any goal. She was just despondent. She was unable to find any sense of direction in what had just occurred. So she didn't know where she was going. She just wandered. And as a result, let's look at the next passage of the story in Source 12, verse 15. Vayichlu hamayim minachemet. The water was depleted. Right? The water was depleted. And Hagar goes ahead. Vatashlecha tayelet. Notice, he doesn't have a name in the whole story. Tachat achad hasichim. He's thrown under one of the bushes. So in the middle of the desert, there's nothing to drink, they've run out of resources, and Hagar is basically unable to care for the child anymore. One interpretation. One interpretation of this, if you look in source 13, is actually the opposite. The Emek Davar says that, and I don't know, the medical people in the room could comment on this. He writes, Od hapam lehorot shenitrachka yoter mitachvei kashet. It says, she distanced herself a bow's shot, the distance that a bow could be shot, that's how far away she went from where Yishmael was. And she said, in verse 16, let me not see the child's death. So she sits from afar. And the distance is two bow shots. Sorry, she says, I don't want to see the child's death. She raises her voice and she cries. So she starts to cry. It's an unbelievable moment. So the Netziv, the Emek Davar, writes in source 13, he says, Ora pam la'orot shenichrakah yomitah v'keshev asher bakasha livkor. She wanted to cry, bekol, with a voice, a loud cry. And she didn't want the child to hear her crying. Why? Shezek kasher l'choleh. Because it would have been difficult for Yishmael, who was basically suffering of dehydration, okay? Beinim omed la'havri, beinim omed la'mut. Is there any basis to this? What do you think? A person who's in a state of dehydration, he's saying that for that person, whether they're on the path to recovery or whether their situation is worsening, having an individual cry before them would be something that would impact them negatively.
Yeah, absolutely.
What's the background to it?
No, it's more mental, I would think, rather than just the
mental
physical.
Right.
You know,
right.
You don't want a lot of people around you,
right,
saying how sick you are, and you know, and that's his mother crying,
right?
So he knows he's on his way out,
right? Right, right.
It's like people standing around a hospital bed crying.
Yeah,
right.
It's the worst thing you can do to someone else in bed.
It's very interesting, right? And this and that commentary, by the way, is really taking the, to me, the way I understand it, it's taking the side that this wasn't something that she was doing as a negative commentary on her. Necessarily, it was she needed to cry, but she couldn't do it in front of the child, so she needed to distance herself. Whereas, if you look in source 14, which I think is the more commonly quoted understanding of this story, is that this is a damning description, that Hagar distancing herself from her child is a statement of callousness. And the idea of being a bow shot away. So look what he writes here. This is just a fascinating idea. He says, in the history of warfare, the invention of the bow and arrow must have been a momentous event. As warriors could now kill their enemies without having to experience their deaths up close. It's the ancient equivalent of using a remote-controlled drone to eliminate an enemy target. I'm in source 14 in the fourth line. The controller sits far away, pushing buttons as if in a video game. The distance of a bow shot is the Bible's way of describing the depth of Hagar's disengagement from her son's fate. A quick calculation reveals that Yishmael is at least 17 years old. Placing Yishmael as a grown young man makes it difficult to understand how his mother can cast him under one of these bushes. How can Hagar toss a 17-year-old boy under a bush? And what child of that age would accept such a thing from his mother? Why does he not pick himself up and walk away? It appears that Yishmael, who until recently believes that he is Abraham's heir, is devastated, not only by Isaac's birth, but by the rejection of both his father and his mother. The crushing blows dealt by that double abandonment could be enough to cripple the spirit of even the healthiest of souls. It does not surprise us then to hear that Yishmael becomes a bowman. He learns from his own experience how easy it can be to kill from a distance. Yishmael becomes Hagar's son. It's a very ironic commentary on what happened in this story. And it's very heart-wrenching to read this description of how crushed This child, he thought everything was going to, everything was set up for him. He was set for life. He was going to get the Yerusha. He was going to be the firstborn. And now, he's nothing. He's rejected. And again, despite the fact, and this is the troubling part, that Abraham showered him with love and he blessed him, he still feels. And how could he not? How could someone blame him for those feelings?
But you say he didn't say anything. Isaac didn't say anything when he was being bound either. He let himself be bound.
There is one conversation.
Why didn't he jump up and say, "Hey, Dad, you're not going to do this to me"?
There is one conversation. We'll see. We're gonna spend some time on that next week. If you look back in the story, it's just at the top of the page there, verse 16, 17. So it's also so fascinating to me. Who was the one who cried? Hagar was the one who cried, and whose voice does God hear and listen to?
Right. He wasn't talking.
So silent in the text is the fact that Yishmael must have been praying, must have been calling out to God. And this is mentioned in some of the commentaries here. I have it in 6 or 16, in the second line, the third line. In 15, that God heard the cry of Yishmael, which is interesting because that's, what's his name? Yishmael, the meaning of his name, right? The meaning of his name, Yishmael, right? And it's, the whole thing is so heart-wrenching, reading the story. God hears his voice. He calls out to Hagar, says to her, "What's troubling you, Hagar? Fear not." It's one interpretation, by the way. Another interpretation of it is what's gotten into you, right? If you look at the Hebrew word is Malach Hagar. What are you thinking? What are you doing? You're throwing your child, you know, under the bushes over there. Al tiri, don't be afraid. God has heard his voice. Kumisi, pick up the lad. Hold his hand. Ki glagoya gadola simen. I'm going to make him into a great nation. And in fact, God opens up her eyes. Again, it's right there. It was there all along. She just didn't see it because of her pain, because of her giving up. She gave up. There was a well right there for her to drink from. Terber mine, terutim lerachemat mine. She fills up the flask and she tashka anar. She gives the boy to drink. Vahil him and anar. Vayigdal. He grows up. Vayeshu mibar. He's a nomad. He's a desert liver, and he becomes a bowman, a rove kasha. The end of verse 20. Vayeshu mibar paran v'tigak lo imo sham eretz mitzrayim. And he gets married. And now the story has an interlude. The interlude is here in source 17. And the interlude is the end of the story of Avimelech. Vahi be'etahi, and it was at that time, v'yorah Avimelech v'chol tzar tzvol Avraham le'mar lo kimimcha. Avimelech realizes that there's an opportunity here to get a partnership, a deal, a negotiation, a transaction with Avram. So one commentary says the reason for this is because I put it here in... people were afraid. They saw that what Avram had done to his, and people heard about it. I guess there was a rumor, and Avimelech got a little bit worried, got a little bit fearful of what was going to happen. So he said, "I need to make a deal with Avram." So he comes to him. He says, "I see that God has been with you." The other commentary here is just, again, the influence of Avram. The influence of Avram has been so great that a person like Avimelech wants to have a part. He wants to invest in the company, right? He wants to invest in the stock of Avram. He sees that the stock of Avram is doing very well, and he says, "This is a good guy to bet on, because if I bet on him, I'll probably win. I'll probably make something off of it." V'ata, verse 23, Shavali Belokim Hena. And remember, Avimelech was giving Avraham a place to live. So he says, "Swear to me that you won't lie to me or my son or my grandson." The commentary say, why does he mention the three generations? I put it here in source 20. The three generations is because maybe they heard about the fact that there was going to be a return of Avraham's descendants in the fourth generation. So for three generations, they would be able to settle in the land that was promised to Abraham. But in the fourth generation, there would be a return. And he says, make a promise to me, right? And don't lie to me. So Abraham gives him rebuke. He rebukes Avimelech, and he says to him, your servants, what do you mean? You were good to me. What are you talking about? You were good to me. Why should I make a deal with you? Your servants
close the wells.
Close the wells. They give us a hard time. Why should I go into a partnership with you? And different commentaries here talk about how, you know, he's a gazlan. He's a person who steals. A person who steals from other people. And a person who steals from other people is not permitted to make a truthful oath. How could I trust you? I'm going to make a partnership with you. How am I even able to trust that you're someone I can rely on? Or alternatively, he's one of the Noahides, right? And the Noahides, one of the rules of the Noahides is theft, geneva. They're not allowed to steal. So why should I rely on you? Vayom Rav Melech, verse 26, Lo yadati miyasad davar zeh, says, I don't know about that. Maybe he really didn't. He's being honest. He says, I don't know who was involved in that. I'm only hearing about it today for the first time. You imagine? He's the king of the president of the country, and he's only hearing about things that are happening, you know, days later, or months later, years later.
Sounds like Mugabe.
Could be a lot of places. People who are out of touch with their daily news. Abraham, son of Akar, so Abraham says, okay, it's possible. You didn't know about it. I'm going to forgive, but again, the rebuke piece is important. I put it here in source 21. Rebuke a wise man and he will love you. That's from, I believe, Mishle. Right? Rebuke could be a good thing. Could be a good thing. It could cause a person to realize they did something wrong and so on. So they make a deal. And Avraham makes this deal. And the deal basically gives Avimelech a portion of land. This is a land for peace type of discussion. And the way that they do the transaction, he gives them sheep and cattle, if you look in verse 27, and they make this breed. Some commentaries say they actually, like Abraham, they cut the animals in half, and they walk through them, like the breed ben abiturim, the covenant of the pieces, by Yitzev Abraham, verse 28, Sheva kifsorat son levadhan, he takes the seven sheep, what do these seven sheep represent? Sheyitzavta levadana, why did you put them by themselves? Verse 30, Pasuk Lamed, Vayomer ki yeshev vasot tikach miyadi, you're going to take these seven, bavur tiela leida, ki chafarti de be'erazot, it's going to be a symbol, right? It's going to be a symbol or kind of a stamp of the sign that I dug this well. And I dug this well. Digging a well is a very strong form of acquisition of land. You dig a hole in a property, that is halachically, the Chatam Sofer speaks about it in source 22, it's a very strong way to create a sense of ownership. And that location was named Be'er Sheva. And this is where the root of that name comes from, the city Be'er Sheva, which stands to this day. Kein Kara LaMakom, verse 31, that place was called Be'er Sheva, Kisham Nishbu. Ashneim, because that was the place where they had this covenant, this breed. And Eretz Plishtim, Philistine, okay, the land of the Philistines is basically modern day Gaza. That's where it is on the map. And that was a site which Abraham basically gave into the hands of Abimelech. So let's wrap up with two final points. One is, this deal, this partnership that Abraham made with Avimelech is viewed, I couldn't find anyone who views it positively. I'll put it to you that way. Every commentary comes and thinks that this was one of the worst decisions that Abraham made. For example, in the Midrash, in source number 23, the Midrash goes on and on, talks about all the after effects, negative after effects. You gave those seven sheep without my permission or my desire. You're going to lose out. You're going to lose seven descendants who are all going to be killed in the future. Chofni, Pinchas, Shimshon, Shaul, Shosha, Banav, his three sons. And he goes on. He talks about the seven Mishkans which are going to be destroyed, including the temple. So, you know, talking about destructive activities and Masse Avot Siman Labanim, which we've spoken about many times here, you know, portending something that's going to negative, it's going to happen in the future. This event of Avram giving Avimelech a hold in the land of Canaan without consulting or doing it on his own accord was something viewed as very negative. And in fact, and this in a way segues into our discussion for our last class next week, is the fact that the Rashbam writes that when it says that God tested Avraham with the Akedah, it doesn't mean tested, but it rather means punished. Nisa, the word Nisa, he looks at that as a painful test, and it was a punishment for Avram going into partnership with Avimelech. It's a very strong language. I put it here in source number 4. Something which is bound to cause him grief. And he says, the connotation, unpleasant one for the one being subjected to it. In this instance, God, so to speak, indicated to Avram, he had been foolish to think that he can guarantee Yitzchak and his descendants well-being in the future, as he might have determined in his life before he even had produced any offspring who would be called upon to honor his father's deal with Avimelech. So God was very upset, and according to one commentary at least, the Akedat Yitzchak was not a test, but it was a punishment that was being brought on Avram for that decision. And finally, at the end of this chapter, we get back to the story of Avraham, and Avraham plants in Eshel, source 25, verse 33 and 34. He plants in Eshel in Be'er Sheva. One commentary says the reason why he did this was to mark his territory, to say, I dug this well, and I want everyone to know that this is my property, so I'm going to put up some trees. And putting up those trees gave it an even more of a sense of that it's undisputed property, as I wrote here, the Radak in source 28. And then the word Eshel, according to Chazal, according to the sages in the Midrash, in Tehillim, is an acronym for Achila Aleph Shin Shtia Lina, eating, drinking, and sleeping, otherwise known as a hotel. Avraham set up a hotel where people could come and be, so Avraham could continue his chesed, his activities of bringing people in and hosting people. The other one other commentary here in 29 says that the whole purpose here, the whole goal here was Avraham was involved in yeshuva aretz. Avraham was settling the land in different places. And Vayikra B'Shem Hashem, in the end of the story, he was calling out in the name of God. This was a place of tefillah, a place of spirituality, a place perhaps of learning, teaching people about God, teaching people about monotheism. And that was one of the goals of this site, of this place, as the Talmud mentions in source 30, to Talmud in Masechet Sota, and the Talmud writes here, Reish Lakish said, do not read the word literally as Vayikra, and he called out, but rather as Vayakri, which if you put the punctuation in a different spot, he caused others to call. Avraham caused others to call. This teaches that Avraham, our forefather, caused the name of the Holy One, blessed be, to be called out in the mouth of all passersby. So what did he do? After they would eat and drink, they would get up to give Avraham a blessing. He says to them, you didn't eat, did you eat from what was mine? You ate from what came from God. Therefore you should thank and praise and bless the one who spoke and the world was created. In this way, Avram caused everyone to call out to God. And again, I just put here in the last source how the Rambam looks, the Rambam in the commentary on the Mishnah, he lists the different tests, the various tests that Avram went through. And in this chapter alone, we have the test of Avimelech, or the end of that test, Avimelech and Sarah. We have the test where Avram has to send away Hagar, which he views as a separate test as Avram having to send away his son Yishmael. Each one was painful. Hagar was married some level to Avraham to send away a wife and to send away a child, both in one shot. Obviously very painful, very difficult moments for Avram. And as we said, according to some among the hardest moments and hardest tests that Avram was faced with. And just one final comment, one final line to wrap up, which is as follows. This final moment in the story, where Avram goes through this very emotional roller coaster in his family life, being a parent, being a father, being a husband, and having to navigate the tension between his wife and his new child Yitzhak and his other son Yishmael and Hagar. At the end of the story, what is Avraham involved in? He's not wallowing in his depression. He builds a hotel and he gets back to business. Vayita Eshel Beversheva. Despite everything he had endured, and that ultimately is really the greatest sign of how great, how amazing he was as a person. And there remains one more test, but we see Avram's ability to get back on his feet and to say, Afal Pichein, I have a mission to accomplish, and I'm going to continue that mission of calling out B'Shem Hashem and bringing Chesed into the world.